And Clinton Golden then was working with the SP. At least I met him through connections in the SP. Now, there were a few SPers, but there were no SWPers that I can remember of in that conference.
These people who were the CIO.
Yes, yes, the union movement,
One of the interesting things about the conference was at one point someone raised the point, they didn't say, I would suspect that it was you, that there were no women on the national, they elected temporary national organizing committee. And that someone raised the point there were no women on the committee and that a woman should be placed in a consultative relationship to represent the point of view of the women of the sewing projects and other women's projects. And then the next statement is unrelated to that. It was just apparently passed over totally.
I don't think I made that because I would never have said consultative. I would have said they should have been on the board. Probably it was one of those other women, and I supported her in it. But it's true that we were just nothing when it came to the total movement, the WPA union movement at the time.
Yeah. So you don't recall any follow-up at all from this conference?
No, none. I don't remember ever having any communications, and I was a recording secretary. From the conference, any of the resolutions that were passed, what had been done about them, or anything else. No?
Well, probably it was probably came at a time where there was already beginning to be increased employment.
Yes, and we were beginning to just bleed and bleed, from the WPA unions. We were very glad about that because we were asking for jobs. And we weren't happy that they were, most of them, the plants were retooling and going into production for the armed forces. Weren't happy about that, and I think that's probably why we kept hammering away that we didn't want the money to go into, war production. We wanted it into jobs that were going to mean something.
Well, then there seems to be a new campaign in 40, beginning in February of 1940, and that's where the militant passed some resolutions about war funds going to the unemployed. And that's when there was a demonstration in front of the welfare building forcing the recognition of the union demand. I think it must have been the takeover of the building that's sitting in the building. Yeah. Can you describe that a little bit in the comments about that one?
Well, that was a pretty good size one, and they had several patrol cars of police going along the street because of the numbers of people and the numbers of banners that we had, and the effigy, great big poles. And I don't know who made that effigy, but it was really a pretty drastic-looking guy hung by the neck, There's the name of the administrator, Van Dyson, I think was his name. And the administrator, we were meeting with him in his office when this demo, and we knew that it was all planned and scheduled and so on. And he was knowing us, and he looked out and saw the demonstration and saw the effigy of himself, and he turned slightly pale. And he excused himself, and he didn't come back into the negotiation. So that's when we just sent up one of the persons down and said, okay, instead of just marching around the building and having a demonstration, walk right in and we'll just sit down until we get an answer. Get this man back into the conference and get an answer. Now, when we did that, the police also got out of their cars and went in there. And we knew that the plants across the group plants were apprised of that many police cars. They would have seen the whole thing and they would be watching it. And so we were rather apprehensive. We thought, oh boy, here comes another pitched battle. But in this case, I'll tell you that the police came up and started talking to us as friends and telling us about some of the intolerable situations that they had been immediately connected with. We took up a collection to go out and buy some bologna and some slices of bread and mustard to have something, because we were there for so long we began to get hungry naturally, and we didn't know how long we were going to be there, how many days or anything else. And the police this is the first time in my memory the police contributed to that collection. We made the sandwiches up. We got the bread and the mustard and the bologna and made the sandwiches up. And I don't remember. We had something to drink, water, whatever. And we stayed there. That sit-in was overnight, and I think the next day, when in the morning, the word came down that they were waiting word. Lansing was waiting word from Washington. And just a matter of a few hours after that, probably in the early afternoon, we got word, and Van Dysen came in. Well, it's all settled, and surplus commodities will be opened up again in Flint, and you can assure your people that as soon as they reach here, delivery will be made. So, again, we claimed another victory, and more leaflets out on the projects and more celebrations. And it's very difficult to operate with unemployed people. Their morale becomes so low, they feel that there's the rejects of the human race. And that's why it's so important all of the time to claim victories and to talk about brotherhood and we are united and to try to tie up their interests of the factory workers with the unemployed and so on. And we had the unique conditions in Flint. They were not able to do that in many other places. But in one industry town, you have the possibilities of dramatizing and of bringing a little bit of pride to the unemployed. We really did. We would give our speeches to them and say, why shouldn't we be proud, you know, that we are banded together? All of your life you have supported this government. You have paid for this government. You've paid for the streets. You've paid for those buses and so on. Why should you feel like you are, your rejects, or that you're not as worthy as others? And it's harder working with them. And then on top of all this, you can say all of these things, point out to them why they shouldn't feel bad, but if you're tired and you're hungry and you're battling people who won't even consider you as human beings in a relief administration, it's very hard keeping your spirits up, much harder than any other kind of organizing I've ever been in.
Now, was this was then both over the relief issue and also to force recognition of the union? Because isn't this when he then started having, he agreed to weekly meetings with the
union? He almost had to recognize our union, but there was no one. If he felt like talking with us, he would. And if he didn't, and when he got into a bind where he felt that there might be trouble, he just avoided it. He was a man who could lock himself in the closet. So I guess that's the first time that we had an agreement that there would be regular meetings on regular days.
Do you recall
to bring up?
Did that in fact happen?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall too many of them because, as I say, this is at the end of the WPA unions. Oh, yes, we had a set time. Mm-hmm. Like every Monday morning at 10 o'clock, and the whole committee would be there, mm-hmm. and we would have everything typed, because I got the job of typing very often, what demands would be for the week.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually got so he would talk to us about the problems mm-hmm. on the job, why he couldn't do this, and what he would try to do. And, of course, again, there's so much government red tape, it's not the results are very slow in coming mm-hmm. from things like that. But the very fact that the poor could come up in that building and know that on Monday morning there was a representative who's going to take it up to the committee and the committee was going to take up his problem
mm-hmm.
was really great.
Dr. Cartman.
So then the next thing, so there was a victory with Van Dysen, then, which is, this seemed to be like a new surge of activity in March of that year. Then the next thing.
Oh, by the way, this isn't important, but there was quite a lot of anti-German sentiment came in on that name of Van Dysen, too. And we had to be always trying to explain to people, you know, don't take advantage of it, because we did have Nazism in Germany by this time.
Then
Nazi dictatorship.
Beginning then is when. There seems to be this fight against you and Roy Lawrence.
Okay, now that's going to be very big.
Okay.
All right, have you got it on?
Yeah.
Oh. The the one thing that stands out in my mind in that regard is, well, first of all, we knew generally that Joe Pagano, an inexperienced Italian man in Detroit, inexperienced with these kind of organizations and activities, wasn't an organizer, didn't quite comprehend what he was supposed to be doing up in that role, and was very concerned that this thing not get out of hand. And we were far too militant, getting far too much publicity for the UAW, which at that time was having its own problems with factional differences. And so he was not happy with us at all. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we couldn't care less how he felt about it. But there was one particular leaflet that I put out, and I copied a huge, big cartoon that came out of one of the CIO papers. I am not sure if it was the UAW paper or one of the other CIO unions. And this cartoon was a bitter thing. It had a big giant representing war appropriations, I think. I don't know. And the little public worker pleading or whatever the connotation was, it was a very sharp, sharp picture that would immediately call to mind, to a man digging a ditch. Look where all of our money's going instead of decent jobs and housing. And so I copied this, copied the picture by, just drawing it and duplicating it on the mimeograph machine, and had our own militant incendiary, I suppose he would think, message beneath it, and announcing the meetings and whatever else. And this leaflet he used as the basis of removing us from office. And I think that he notified the president, who he was the president and the secretary treasurer, or the former president, I don't know. He notified a couple of people in our local union, because Claude Workman at that point, I think, was the president. Or maybe we elected Claude as basis of that. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
All right. He had a couple of people in there who were conservatives and who also were a little bit concerned about what might happen if we got too militant. And charges were preferred against us to remove us from office. And he said, no, he had the authority to do this directly from the International Union. Now, the only thing that I know is after that, we threw out his people that he had, the two officers he was working with, through. And we had big, big meetings. And when he came down from Detroit to Flint, we made a trip up to Detroit to explain to him. But he was such an arrogant son of a gun.
You and Workman?
No, our whole top executive committee, I think there was a carload of five of us, or six, went down to explain to him. And he was a very arrogant man. And we could get nowhere with him. And he didn't make his own decisions. I don't know where his decisions were coming from, but we gathered then that there was no further purpose in our talking to him. So we invited him to a meeting in Flint. By the time we had moved it to a different address, we had a larger hall. And this meeting was so large that we had to have planks put on boxes to seat all of the people. And then they were standing up in the back of the room. And Joe Pagano came down there. And believe me, not only were we reinstated, the elections came out, we were reinstated and with his consent, but he was faced with a picture of the original CIO paper from whence we took the cartoon, which was the basis, ostensibly, of the charges against us. But Joe Pagano was just tickled to death to recant and to apologize and to almost plead for safe passage out of that hall. It was a packed meeting. It was a very dynamic meeting. And, of course, we didn't have to say one word in defense because the workers from the project came in and just packed the place and told Joe Pagano where he could go, and they didn't want him back in Flint again. So then, of course, shortly after that, we had elections, and these two officers were thrown out. And Claude Workman, I believe, was then elected the president, Pat Murray, and the rest of the crew.
You know, in there are those letters in May about Dupre not releasing the funds. Is that part of it, that they were holding back the funds because of this fight?
It's possible. I don't remember. It's possible. I don't know. Dupre, and several of us suspected him of being an agent of perhaps the corporation or something. We never got any hysteria over it, but we did not trust the man. And he seemed to be very, had some kind of backing for us. He was alone. He didn't have anybody supporting him in this position.
Now, was Lawrence in the SWP at this point also?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm sure.
Now, what was the role of the CP in all of this fight? Were they interested in it or supporting Pagano? Or?
No, they were in the Workers' Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Workers' Alliance had nothing to do with the UAW, and Pagano had nothing to do with the Workers' Alliance. So they, if there was any talk on the job, they probably would be against the whole idea of Local 12 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They would prefer to have them in their own union, the Workers' Alliance.
And then that seems to have been the end of, well, during this period, they actually pulled the charter as well as
yes, but it was reinstated after the Pagano meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they sent notice that they were pulling the charter of the local. They didn't want the responsibility or something like that. And, of course, because of the period and because of the factories calling men back to work, it was no longer a great big issue for very long. We had the elected officers. We continued with our work. And I myself then went over on the professional projects somewhere right along in this period or shortly thereafter.
Now, when was it that you started to work on the WPA?
I don't know. I can't tell you that, and I can't tell you how long I was there. I was trying to figure it out the other day. I don't know how many months I was. I can tell you this very interesting part of it. The first project that I was put on was in the timekeeping department of the library project.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first one. And that and a couple of other recreation projects, library, and a couple of others were located in the water plant of the city of Flint. And I was working on that. And one day one of our Flint newspapers called the Flint News Advertiser, not as large as the Journal, but as much company-dominated as the Journal, a big headline came out. Flint's leading red in position to blow up the water supply of the city. And, my gosh, I tell you, the whole city was aghast. And, of course, the moment I saw it, well, I was named in it also, but the moment I saw the headline, I thought, oh, no, not again. And there was such a big to-do about it. The first thing was they demanded that I be fired immediately, if not sooner. I could poison everybody or blow it up. Poison was the main threat. That was it. Nobody would know if I put poison in the water supply of the whole city. And the woman who hired me, the head of the whole professional services division, was a very interesting woman born in India and a member of the Labour Party of England, raised in England. She was of English parentage. And she was a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
But in this country, she was a foreigner. And she was married to a Swiss. And when I was in the sixth grade, her little son was my boyfriend. And she knew me this way. And she knew where I came from, my whole family background. So she was a secret admirer of mine. I didn't know it, really, at the time until she called me into her office over this whole water project thing. And she said, "Can't they get ridiculous?" And I said, "Well, I suppose," her name was India Myers. I said, "I suppose, Mrs. Myers, that you're going to have to release me." I said, "That you were the one who were directly responsible for hiring me." And she said, "No, I think we can find another way. We don't need to fall into this trap of hysteria or something like that." She transferred the whole doggone WPA project out of the water department premises completely. And so the city apparently lost some kind of revenue from the federal government as a result. And then when the new district administration building was completed, why it was transferred up there.
Now, you know, so you were actually working with the WPA by this point in the activity with Local 12. Was there any problem? Was there any pressure on you because of your involvement in the local?
No, because at this time the pressures were off from the projects. The thing seemed to be sort of winding up for the men. See, the men were the ones being called back into the shops. The men were the ones who usually were the ones who were doing the demonstrating. The professional projects were mainly women. There were men in some of them, recreation naturally, but the biggest bulk of them were women. And these were not active in the union. Mm-hmm. They were sort of separate and apart. It was a minority at the mm-hmm. WPA operation nationally, too. So when I was over there, then the activities of the union itself was sort of petering out, tapering down. Mm-hmm. And this is when they began actually instituting training programs to train people for war production plans, mm-hmm. you know.
So during this time of the fight where they pulled the charter is, and you were already in the bookkeeping.
I think I went on that after the big fight. I think that after that was over, we elected our own officers, and then it became, went on that when it became almost a business as usual operation. Now you must remember that also I was participating in discussions on what was happening in the UAW. Homer Martin's the tactics and fights and so on against the other group. And we were having all kinds of discussions going on in that regard, too. That was a big interest of mm-hmm. mine also.
And then at the same time, you seem to be becoming more and more involved as a spokesperson for the SWP.
Yes, because it became, the war issue for me was very, very important, for the whole movement, for the whole socialist movement. And that became a much bigger interest to me than any project mm-hmm. Operations. And again, here, when on the WPA project, there was a collection being taken up from everybody in supervisory capacity in the district office for the campaign fund of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I refused to contribute, and the demand went up from every head of every one of those projects that I be dismissed. It was FDR who put this program in effect, and if I didn't want to contribute to his reelection, that I should be dismissed. And this is an organized mm-hmm. thing. And again, Mrs. Myers, with her socialist background, just held firm on that. And I wasn't dismissed. But that was my primary concern at that point. And there I was opening up on FDR because of the whole business of the orientation toward, you know, military buildup. And it looked like we might be entering into mm-hmm. the war.
Because it seemed, because that's when it was more and more focused on introducing resolutions within the
yes.
WPA local on the
yes,
world.
That's right.
We came from you,
that's right. And we went into the UAW locals because we were still interested in all of our contacts. We were still maintaining them all.
Now, at some point, when you went into the WPA work, that was to release permit to organize what?
To be organizing on the project sites where the men were working mm-hmm. and where a woman would not have been effective. I couldn't have done the same job out there as he could have because these were tough, rough areas mm-hmm. where you had to wear heavy boots and men had picks and shovels and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have been more effective, but it also was because personally we were in a very dire situation ourselves. And we were way behind and creditors were bugging us and it was becoming very difficult. So I could earn more money naturally than he could as an ordinary worker. It wasn't easy for him to accept, but we did have at first it seemed like a good idea, rather, a very good idea, because this was his natural force, speaking and organizing. He loved it.
But when he did go off of it, then it was to be officially being organized for
mm-hmm.
the local, not
unpaid,
uh-huh.
because we didn't have any funds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was a very effective one.
And because that way he can go from site to site, whereas when mm-hmm. he was on the project, he was
right. Right. Or he would have to take time off from work or leave early or something
mm-hmm.
if it was something very, very important. This way he was one of the people that could go from site to site.
Now, through through this period then, you were both very actively involved in organizing, at the same time in organizing the SWP chapter within Flint.
Yes, we were, but we weren't doing the kind of fundamental educating work, but we were recruiting and with workers, we would say, well, the final basic answer, you know, to our problems has got to be a change in the whole system, and we would get into discussions with them and tell them why we belonged. You know, if you are a dedicated person, many times people come up and say, well, what motivates you? What turns you on? Why do you sacrifice like this? So you have to tell them a little bit about your philosophy, and in the end they say, gee, we'd like to be like you, or we'd like to be with you. And so this is the way we were building.
And what kind of reaction was there to the anti-war statements? Because after all, that many of the men were going back to the factories as a result of the war buildup.
I think that it was really the feeling of all the people in that area, and perhaps nationally, that they were building up to supply other nations, building up arms, or to build an arsenal in case. But I think it was really the deepest feelings that they did not want to get involved in another war, because we heard references to World War I and what came out of it and what didn't come out of it and so on. And I really believe that it was the deep sentiment of the ordinary working man. Yes, he wanted a job. And even if it was war production, you know, he was hoping that it would be for the aid of our allies or as a stockpile or something. But that's where we could talk and be accepted at the same time that the plants were retooling for war production.
Because there seems to be a fair amount of organizing around introducing the anti-war resolutions into first of the 12 and then having it go to the CIO council.
That's right. The state director then of the state CIO council was a man by the name of August Scholl, who was an SP member and a very fine person. He married Kathleen Jones, who was the daughter of an old SP member, and they were pacifists and anti-war people. And he had a strong influence on the council. I think it was Norm Bowie then, who was the council chairman in Flint. He had strong influence on them. And then also, if you remember, FDR himself was saying, I'll never send your sons to die across the ocean. And so the whole nation was hoping that we would never get involved, although they liked the jobs and so on, but they wanted to express themselves. We are anti-war as far as involvement for us.
So as the WPA union activity was beginning to kind of die down, the main issue became the war and then the reactions and threats against people like Father Coughlin, and he was in Detroit, wasn't he?
Royal Oak, right outside of Detroit,
Now, was
but he had great listening audience influence, a great listening audience. And he was truly fascist in his old makeup because he sounded like a militant and on the side of the poor and on the side of the unwanted. And yet he would put across in the most insidious manner the most reactionary propaganda.
So, Janora, by this time you were being viewed, it seems like, as an active organizer and leader within the SWP itself, because there's that meeting in June of 39 that you attended, and then going to this CIO drive in Goshen. Although I guess that wasn't under the SWP, that was under the CIO. So it seems like you were being both pushed as by the party. As a leader within the SWP.
Goshen, Indiana, yes. That was a CIO representative who had recently come around to the idea of the SWP himself. And he was the one who initiated that, I think. Yes, that's true. I was being pushed into the forefront more and more. And I guess that it had value for them. And I was so terribly interested in trying to do what I could to make the American workers anti-war anti-offensive war, you know, that I was willing to accept it.
But it was pretty clear that you were the one who was pushing up Kermit, isn't it, at that point?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
By this point, he was beginning to sort of decline in terms of his drinking.
Yeah, he was having a few problems, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so you remained in the WPA, and then he went to Detroit to look for work?
When the WPA just petered out, and then the factories called back, and the unemployed was no longer a problem there, we were going pretty fast toward full employment. Then he looked for a job, and I guess I don't remember now the circumstances. I think he wasn't taken back into Plant 4 after all of this. When he did get back into Chevrolet, they took him into another plant because of his effectiveness as a speaker. And I think that he went to Detroit to look for work. And he was down there, came home weekends, and he was down there for 6 months, and he fell in love with somebody else, and he was living with somebody else. I didn't know that for 6 months, but that's the way the thing resolved itself.
And that's when you started talking about separation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. When I found out about it, I was naturally quite shocked because I was working and supporting the kids and we were going out without a lot of things like mittens and gloves and things like that in cold weather to give him money to travel back and forth. And, of course, we had comrades and friends in Detroit, and this is where he said he was staying. And he was getting a little bit more and more nervous on weekends and didn't want to be bothered with the kids. And one day I became very suspicious, and I asked his dad if he could drive down to Detroit and see what was going on. And so when we got there, I went to the place he was supposed to be in the winter, and so I called a friend of mine who didn't recognize my voice. And he said, "Well, you know, he's living over there with Winnie." And I said, "But I don't have the number." And before he knew who was calling, I had the address, and Dad and I went over there. His father and I went over there. And we saw on the door, you know, it was Mr. and Mrs. Kermit Johnson. So I just wanted to come home, turn around and come home. And when he came home that weekend, he came in to start telling me the usual little tale. And I said, why have you been lying to me all of this time? Why don't you tell me the truth?" And he said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And I said, "Dad and I were down to Detroit on Grand Avenue at your place." And that's when he decided immediately that he had made a big mistake. And I said, I think we had a reconciliation, and then it fell apart. And finally I said, "The only way you're going to make up your mind is if I go a long ways away. I'm going to take a leave of absence from my job, and I'll go to New York with my sister and give you time to think about it," because he swore that, you know, how what men usually say. And then I went to New York with my sister. Then I met. Yes, then I met Sal. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you took a leave, this was from the WPA job still?
Yes, this was from the project at Early Hospital.
And that last one, that was an audiovisual project.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Then after you met Sal, I just want to try and get us up to the point where you moved to Detroit so that we can start the next time. Then you met Sal at a party?
Yes, there was a big social gathering of the Socialist Workers' Party, and my sister and I went. And he had just come in from a trip from Africa. He was in the Merchant Marine. And he met me that night. The next day he wanted to show us around because I had forgotten the layout of New York, and I was asking if anyone was available to go around with us. And so he took us to see Orson Welles. What is that one about the Hearst?
Citizen Kane.
And he took us to other places around the city for quite some time because a seaman gets paid off in a lump sum. And he was just in his glory that he had me around and could show me all over. And I was staying at the home of, we were staying in a hotel at first, and then when my sister had to go back. And all this time, he thought that I was married, my sister was single. And he was not too interested in my sister. And when she left, she told him that I had finally gotten a letter and that it was all over between me and my husband, and that I was very depressed about the whole thing because of the kids and so on. And this is when he decided that he made arrangements for me to go into the home of the family, friends that I knew had known there too, and to stay longer until I sort of got myself together. And every day he came over then. And he didn't tell anybody else in New York what he knew, because he said he didn't want any competition. And then when he, after, I don't know, a week or 10 days or something, he asked, how it came about, I don't know. He asked me to marry him. And I was surprised that my sister told him, because he didn't tell me before. And, of course, I had no conception of marrying anybody at all at that stage, and especially somebody who had never been married and was that much younger than I. And you know what a woman will do sometime in a case like that to discourage a man? I told him I had very, very bad teeth, which was true. Always had to do a lot of work on my teeth. I had one lung from tuberculosis, that I was much older than he.
What was the age of this?
7.5 years. And that he was only 10 years older than my oldest son, and that I didn't need to take somebody out of the cradle to come and live with me. I had two sons already, and I didn't need anybody else to take care of. And I painted myself as a person who made my own decisions, and I didn't need anybody else. I was trying very hard to discourage him. And I said, beside two children, and a boy, you know, just 10 years younger than yourself is not an easy problem. And I wasn't successful in any of it. He said that he didn't care if I had 10 kids, that I was the person that he wanted very much to be married with and just give him a chance to prove himself. And if he didn't prove himself, I could take him out in the backyard and bury him or do whatever I wanted to. But, God, I hope that doesn't get transcribed.
Well, and then you went back to Flint Falls, this
yes.
Convention that you all went to in Chicago.
Oh, five of us drove back to Chicago, and then we went back to Flint. And then there was this accident with the car. And Sal never went back to New York again.
Oh, he just stayed in Flint.
Mm-hmm. But he had to ship out. In order to either be drafted or he had to be shipped out in the Merchant Marine. And this is the time that he, shortly after that, that he had to go back and ship out, and he was nearly lost his life, you know, when his ship was sunk I can't think of any part of it. Well, it was a big convoy of 40-some ships, and out of 42 ships, I guess 38 of them were sunk.
Mm.
And he was in a life raft, and his feet and legs were frozen. And they landed on the island north of Russia in Nova Zembla, and then an armed plane brought him back down into the hospital in Russia. And the reports came out that there were no survivors from the SS Olopana, and I thought he was dead for quite some time, and I was feeling very punk about that. This is when I went over into the, from the Hurley Hospital project, I asked to be transferred over into the training project to learn how to run milling machines and grinders and use calipers and micrometers and things like that to be trained, you know, blueprint reading.
What the idea behind your wanting to get the training was to go into
yes.
the industry, the
yes.
war industry.
Yes, I had to make a living, and you couldn't do it on WPA, that is. Beginning to phase out anyway. Mm-hmm.
But was it to go into factory work so that you could do organizing still within the factory rather than...
Naturally. Naturally. Of course, we were office workers. We weren't getting anywhere in organizing office workers. And it was, of course, to be back into the union movement. It was something that I knew very well and I could be of great assistance.
And then he came back in 42... And then you moved to Detroit right after you came back.
And I had just about completed my training course by that time, and we moved to Detroit.
Okay, and then that begins the wartime work experience.
That begins the wartime work experience.
Now, up until this point, he was involved in the SWP. Kermit was involved in the SWP. You were involved in the SWP. Until that later period when you moved back to Detroit after the war, were you all relating to each other for that brief period before he shipped out in your political work or not? Or was that a very brief period?
Kermit had moved to Detroit with this woman.
Oh.
Then.
So that the organizing where Kermit and Saul worked together was later then?
Yes, after later. When we went back to Flint the second again. Yes.
Okay. How long the program
That's
was.
That's what I was trying to think of before you turned it on.
And it was specifically to learn how to use instrumentation.
All the machinery, yes. There was lathe work, of course, naturally took the longest. Milling machines and grinding and, yes, that's all it was.
And were the other people being trained women? Predominantly, or was it mixed?
Mixed. Let's see. I think that there were. You see, shop workers, the production workers in the auto factory could be hired in right off the street, and really all they needed was a little brawn. But a lathe operator or a milling machine or something like that was a little step up, even inside, may not be skilled labor, and very often it was. And so I think practically all of the men in my class, all the people in my class were men with the exception of about four or five of us women.
Mm-hmm.
And I scored very high in the class. I was highly motivated, especially in the blueprint reading and the calipers and miking things out, things like that. I got very high on my test scores. And because it was an intensive training, for war production, they had some damn good instructors, and they put us through our paces. It was
and
no
the training
Mickey Mouse
was
course.
Done by WPS.
Yes.
So, this would have been before the intense mobilization of women. It actually happened a couple months later, I think.
Yeah.
And later in 42.
Yes.
And we're usually trained within their factories.
Right.
Okay, well, that.